Yeah, so our theme for this year at Sangonai is the refuge tree, or the tree of refuge and respect, it's sometimes called. And it's a symbolic pictorial image. It's a representation of the three jewels of Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And we've been in the process of exploring the refuge tree at the moment. And over the past few weeks, we've been looking at the three protectors, who are three figures on the refuge tree. And they're three figures who draw out three aspects of enlightenment. There's Manjugosha, who we've looked at, who draws out wisdom, the wisdom of the enlightened mind. Avalokiteshvara, who is an expression of the compassion of the Buddha, the compassion of the enlightened mind. And last week, Maitridharta talked about Vajrapani, who is the archetypal figure associated with the transformation and the harnessing of our energies, with energy and volition. So, if you can imagine an iceberg, I'd like you to imagine an iceberg. And the very tip of the iceberg that we can see above the surface of the water, well, that could be likened to our rational mind, or the energies that drives in us that we're conscious of, and the bits of us that we're aware of and that we're conscious of. And the great mass below the sea that we can't see, below the surface, well, that could be likened to our mysterious, murky depths. The energies, the drives, the aspects of our being that we're either dimly aware of or just completely unaware of. And one approach to the spiritual life could be seen as a process of deepening our awareness, just becoming more and more aware, bringing more and more aware, more and more of ourselves into awareness, integrating that and becoming a bigger being, a more effective being. And there's a model called the stages of the path. And Sangha actually describes this process of becoming a bigger being in terms of integration and positive emotion. So at the first stage, we're integrating all of these energies through deep awareness. And in the second stage of positive emotion, we're channeling more and more of this energy into more skillful directions, into more cultivating more positive states, more positive emotion. And we'll come back to stages 3 and 4 later on. So, go back to this picture of the iceberg, which is here. And the importance of harnessing these deeper energies is illustrated by an example that we use on the intermediate course of a rider and a horse. So you could liken the rational mind, the bits of us we're aware of, to the rider on a horse. And basically, we make the decision we're going to travel in this direction towards awakening. That's the direction we want to head in. But meanwhile, the horse, which is our unconscious depths and our deeper emotions, well, the horse just goes wherever it wants to, and it takes the rider with it. So really, the horse might be interested in some nice hay, some nice food, or a horse of the opposite sex, an attractive horse. So really, where the horse goes where it wants to, we're driven by our emotions, our unconscious depths. So really, it's vital that we learn to speak the language of our depths, that we can get these parts of us on side, we can integrate them, get them behind our spiritual practice. So we need to harness our depths, we need to get them on board. And so this evening's talk, I'll be largely speaking the language of the horse, the language of the depths. But there will be plenty of lists as well to keep the rational mind happy as well. So there'll be, but largely, I'm going to be speaking in the area of myths, stories and images this evening. So we heard a great talk last week from Maitridharta about how Vajrapani is associated with harnessing these energies and transforming these energies on the spiritual path. And there's another Buddhist symbol which is associated with this process and these energies, and that's the symbol of the Naga. So Nagas appear right from the very earliest suttas of Buddhism, the very earliest suttas of the Pali Canon. And they're beings that dwell usually in the depths of the ocean, the dark, murky region below the surface. And they're powerful serpent beings with great coils of energy and shiny scales. And they're closely related to their Western cousins, the dragon. And like dragons, Nagas are entrusted with guarding treasure, keeping treasure out of harm's way deep down in the depths. And often we see the Nagas serving the Buddha. So in a similar way to Vajrapani, who's a protector, We often see the Nagas serving and protecting the Buddha. And a very famous account of this is the account of the Naga king, Mucchalinda, who appears in a sutta which is very rich in symbolism. So when the Buddha was just enlightened, when he was newly awakened, he entered into a period of meditation for 7 days, absorbing the bliss of the enlightenment experience. Then suddenly a great storm cloud appeared. It was out of season, and it covered the whole area with very cold, rainy weather and an intense darkness. And then the Naga king, Mucchalinda, he left his Naga realm and he emerged out of the depths and encircled the Buddha's body 7 times with his coils, basically to protect the Buddha, to shelter the Buddha from the storm and from the rain. And then when the Buddha emerged from his meditation 7 days later, the Naga king uncoiled himself, transformed into a youthful prince, and saluted the Buddha, bowed and saluted the Buddha. So that's an account of a Naga as a protector in service of the Buddha. And you might guess, well, I've got a particular interest in Nagas and dragons. I'm particularly fond of Nagas and dragons. And that's partly the reason why Moga Banks has given me the name Bodhi Naga, because of my fascination, my connection with Nagas. But I haven't always been interested in Nagas and dragons. And until recently, I wasn't even slightly interested in them. I wasn't even interested in them in the slightest. But that all changed about 4 years ago. And 4 years ago, I was sitting in the Red Shrine Room in the Buddha Center downstairs, and I was doing a particularly dull mindfulness of breathing, trying to follow my breath without much luck. And out of the corner of my eye, I had a glimpse in my meditation of something shiny, which it caught my eye, it interested me, caught my attention. And I'd been on a retreat at Padmaloka called the Mythic Context, and we'd been encouraged just to explore any associations or any images that came up, and just to explore them. So I thought, well, I'm going to explore this. My mindfulness of breathing is a bit dull this morning. I'm going to go after this treasure and see what's going on here. And and there was a sense of there being a treasure chest in the, in my imagination, in my meditation. And as soon as I made that decision to explore the treasure, I got a sense of there being something, something very strong, something very powerful, which was saying, don't go near the treasure. Basically, there's a sense of there being something, something bigger than myself saying, don't go near the treasure. You're not ready for the treasure. This isn't for you. Keep back away from the treasure. So I thought, fair enough, I'll go back to the mindfulness of breathing. Maybe the mindfulness of breathing isn't so dull after all. I'll go back to the and do what the meditation I've been taught to do. And I was immediately, I became fascinated in dragons overnight. Straight after that, I just became fascinated with Nagas and dragons. I wanted to know why is there this symbol of the Naga and the dragon in Buddhism? What's it about? Why is there this Naga image? Why does it appear so often in Buddhist suttas? And what are my depths trying to say to me? What lesson do I need to learn from my depths? So I became really interested in the symbolism around Nagas overnight, really. And so what I'd like to do this evening is just share some of the things I've learned from my inner dragon over the last few years. And it's going to be a practical talk. And in particular, I want to look at what to do if one meets a dragon. What to do if you meet a dragon. And in particular, where do dragons live? What weapons will you need if you're going to take on a dragon? And what is the treasure? The most important one, what is the treasure? What is the treasure? So what to do if you meet a dragon? And who better to learn from than the Buddha Shakyamuni? So I've got a sutta that I'd like to read out to you. So thus have I heard. The Blessed One journeyed on by stages till he at length arrived at Uruvela. Now at that time, 3 matted-haired ascetics were living at Uruvela, called Kashyapa of Uruvela, Kashyapa of the River, and Kashyapa of Gaya. Kashyapa of Uruvela was the leader, guide, chief, head, and principal of 500 matted-haired ascetics. Kashyapa of the River of 300, and Kashyapa of Gaya of 200. The Blessed One went to the hermitage of Kashyapa of Uruvela, and he said, Kashyapa, if you have no objection, I should like to spend one night in your fire chamber. I have no objection, great monk, but there is a savage royal Naga serpent there. He has supernormal powers. He is venomous, fearfully poisonous, and capable of killing you. The Blessed One asked a second time and a third time, and received the same reply. He said, perhaps he will not destroy me, Kashyapa, so grant me the fire chamber. Then stay there as long as you like, great monk. So the Blessed One went into the fire chamber. He spread out a rush mat and sat down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect and establishing mindfulness in front of him. When the Naga saw the Blessed One come in, he was angry and produced smoke. Then the Blessed One thought, suppose I counter his fire by fire without injuring his outer skin or inner skin. He did so and produced smoke. Then the Naga, no longer restraining his fury, produced flames. The Blessed One entered upon the fire element and produced flames too. The fire chamber seemed to burn and blaze and glow with their flames. The matted hair ascetics gathered round and they said, the great monk who is so beautiful is being destroyed by the Naga. When the night was over and the Blessed One had countered the Naga's fire by fire without injuring him, he put him into his bowl and showed him to Uruvela Kashyapa. This is your Naga, Kashyapa. His fire has been countered by fire. So, yeah, just over a year ago, I was lucky enough to have an hour visit with Sangharakshita. It's possible to go and visit Sangharakshita for an hour. And I had a visit with him, and it's not surprising, one of the topics I wanted to talk to him about was Nagas and dragons. And in particular, I asked him about the sutta and what he thought the sutta was about. And he said, well, the answer he gave to me is, well, it's important not to try and rationalise and explain away the sutta, perhaps saying, well, maybe there were some people in the fire chamber, they lit a fire, it looked like there was a fire, it looked like there might have been a dragon inside. He said it's important not to try and explain away with the rational mind this sutta. And so I decided to take an imaginative approach to this sutta, and I've come up with my own interpretation, really, my own Bodhinaga commentary on this sutta. And the Buddha taught in lots of different ways in order to speak to people of different temperaments and to speak to the different parts of us. And I think here we've got an example of a teaching delivered as a story or a metaphor for an inner experience. And it's maybe similar to the enlightenment stories, the stories of the Buddha surrounding the Buddha's enlightenment. So the plain facts of the Buddha's enlightenment are that he sat under a tree for a very long time, and then he got up again, and then he stood and he stared at a tree for a very long time. So they were the plain facts of the Buddha's enlightenment. And they don't reveal very much about what might have happened, what might have gone on. But the suttas, the suttas tell a very colourful and vivid account of encounters with different mythical beings. And they create a much richer account of what the Buddha's inner experience might have been like. So whether you prefer to think of these encounters taking place in the outer world or the inner world, it doesn't really matter from the point of view of enlightenment. But this evening I'm going to approach the sutta as an account of an inner experience. And for me this is a teaching about how to work in meditation. And I'll explain more about that shortly. And the main part of the story takes place with the Buddha deep in meditation, with a fire-breathing Naga in a fire chamber. So the first question to address in our dragon hunt is where does the Naga dwell? Where does the dragon dwell? What is the fire chamber? What does this convey? What does it symbolise? And the element of fire is associated with the transformation of energy, and it's also associated with the burning heat of strong emotion. So for me, the fire chamber represents the chamber of strong emotion, the heart chamber, or the fire chamber of the heart. And Kashyapa and his followers are afraid to go into the fire chamber. They don't want to go into the fire chamber. So I don't know what it's like for women in the audience or for men from different parts of the world, but for northern men, we don't go in the fire chamber. When I grew up, what I learned from my dad is, don't go in the fire chamber, son. men don't have emotions. Well, we pretend we don't have them, but actually, we're scared of strong emotion. That's the truth. And this evening I'll be speaking largely about anger. But what I'm going to say is equally applicable to any strong emotion. And I expect there will be different emotions that will be frightening for different people. And it's equally applicable to different emotions. So what happens if you don't engage your emotions and the energy that goes behind them? What happens? Well, in the religion of art, Sangharakshita likens the emotions to Cinderella. And he says, if Cinderella is not allowed to go to the ball, she will not stay quietly at home doing the dishes. Probably she will set the home on fire instead. So if we don't engage our emotions, they shout louder to get our attention. And if we continue to ignore them, they become destructive. And they appear to us as monsters or demons, and we're even more afraid to go into the fire chamber. But when we start to meditate, and we start to begin to develop some awareness, we might realise that we've got all kinds of monstrous emotions that we think we're not supposed to experience. So emotions such as hatred, jealousy, forbidden sexual desires, rage that we're not supposed to experience. So it may feel like things have gone backwards when all of a sudden we become aware of all kinds of scary, murky, dark emotions. Or we may just experience a sense of doom or foreboding of what we might lift the lid on, what we might find out, what we might discover. So we feel threatened. Our story of who we are is threatened. And an aversion response kicks in, or a fight or flight response. We want to get rid of the experience. We want to push it away. We don't want that experience. And we end up with a dragon in our fire chamber. And we end up with a door firmly locked and a no entry sign on the fire chamber. Don't go in. So there are two ways in which this might commonly occur. And the first one which I've experienced is denial. So, well, what fire chamber? What emotions? I don't get angry. What anger? What do you mean? I'm a nice Buddhist. I don't get angry. But if we're in denial, then the dragon attacks unconsciously. The dragon leaks out and it harms people unconsciously without us realising. In our speech, in our actions. Or maybe we're just dimly aware of something that we're ashamed of, and we experience guilt, we experience self-hatred. And secondly, another form it can take, when we can't really deny these emotions exist any longer, perhaps we might decide consciously just to repress the emotion, just to push it away. We don't want anything to do with it, so we consciously make a decision just to repress the emotion. So these emotions, they don't fit in with what I'm trying to be. I'm trying to be a nice Buddhist. I don't want anything to do with these emotions. So we keep the door to the fire chamber firmly locked. We push the fire chamber away into a corner and we get on with trying to become a nice Buddhist. And maybe this approach could be characterised by a very disciplined, very willful approach in meditation, which can happen, where you can force your way into a concentrated state, but with just a very limited part of yourself, a very limited part of yourself that you've got access to, and you basically abandon, you leave the rest of yourself behind. And this approach is sometimes called spiritual bypassing, where you can kind of, with gritty determination, you can will your way into blissful states using different techniques maybe. But effectively you bypass large parts of your being, your depths, and they remain untransformed, untouched. And Sangharakshita calls this a forcible disruption of one part of the psyche from the rest. So there's a seminar that Sangharakshita gave. He studied a section of the Sutta Nipata called the Chapter of the Snake. And I was studying this seminar when I was away in Spain, and I found it very interesting. And he talks a lot about how to work with emotions in this sutta. And one thing he says is that the ordinary approach of the spiritual life is that you bash your passions on the head. You sort of knock them half unconscious. You knock yourself half unconscious too in the process. Then you can't do very much. So if you don't go into the fire chamber, you end up cutting off all the energy bound up in these strong emotions. And most of our energy gets used up in the conflict trying to keep the door closed. So we just don't have very much energy available to us. And this was a state I was in about 4 years ago. I was in it as this kind of state 4 years ago. I was carrying around a lot of guilt, self-hatred. My emotions felt blocked. I felt cut off from my gut instincts, my intuition. I was cut off from all the energy that came with those emotions. It was like turning down the volume of my emotions. I didn't really feel anything in particular very strongly. I had no clear sense of what to do with my life. I had a sense that there was a part of me that did know, but I just felt cut off from it. So that's what can happen if you push away emotions, you don't engage with them. If you're not prepared to go into the fire chamber. So what does the Buddha do? What did the Buddha do? How does the Buddha help Kashyapa? Well, the Buddha leads by example and he enters the fire chamber. So I'm imagining a fire chamber probably about the size of the Red Shrine Room downstairs, maybe a bit bigger, a building about that, those kind of dimensions. And a naga, probably about two-thirds of the room is filled with a big naga, a big fire-breathing naga. And so the Buddha sits down, he gets his meditation mat out and his cushions, or his, you know, whatever they had in Uruvela, and he establishes himself in mindfulness. So the first thing we need to do, if we're encountering a dragon, the first thing we need to do is enter the fire chamber and establish mindfulness. So I'd like to say a little bit about how we work with mindfulness in emotion, in meditation. And this is where some of the lists come in for people who like lists. There's lots of different, well, there's the different lists about mindfulness, the different descriptions of mindfulness. One of the most common is the Satipatthanas, or the four foundations of mindfulness. And so the Buddha establishes mindfulness. And so what that means is, in this list, there's four areas, four parts of your experience that you can become mindful of, you can become aware of. The first, and probably for me, which has been the most important, is the body, mindfulness of the body. So that includes every sensation of the body, all the sensations of the body. And the body is where our direct experience takes place. It's where we experience physical contact with the world. And the body is also where we experience emotion and energy. So we experience knots or waves of emotion or energy in the body. It's where we might experience the tightening up of anxiety or the expansiveness of metta. Or maybe a knot in the stomach, which is blocked anger or anger itself. So this is the first sphere, the first foundation of mindfulness, is becoming aware of your body. Becoming grounded and rooted in the body. And then the second is Vedana, mindfulness of Vedana. And Vedana basically means our preferences, our likes and dislikes. It's whether we find an aspect of our experience pleasant or unpleasant. So the Buddha's, and we can become mindful of our body, and we can become mindful of whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, the Vedana. And then the third aspect we can become aware of in any moment is Citta. And Citta means heart or mind. And so this area covers all the aspects of our experience, anything that might arise in our heart or mind. So it includes emotions, volitions, intentions, our thoughts, whatever arises in the heart or mind. And then finally, mindfulness of Dharma or Dharmas. And I take this to mean basically what I need to do in this situation. What dharmically do I need to do in this moment? So it includes your commitment to ethics, your commitment to the goal, to the path, what you're trying to become. Staying mindful of that, mindful of your goal, mindful of your purpose. And what exactly do I need to do in this situation? So if you want the treasure, if you want to get the treasure of the dragon, and you don't establish mindfulness, well then you're going to be dragon meat. You're going to be dragon fodder. You must establish mindfulness, and in particular mindfulness of the body is the kind of root mindfulness. So if we're not mindful of what's going on, if we're not paying attention to these satipatthanas, then most likely we're going to be caught up in our own stories, drifting around from one thought to the next thought. And this is what the Buddha has called prapancha, or mental proliferation. Prapancha. And for me, this is what's signified by the smoke that the dragon, that the naga produces. It's a subtle first line of defence of the dragon, where the dragon fills the fire chamber and clouds the mind with prapancha. So for me, I might experience the smoke as a voice that says something like, a bit like, this is no good, you can't meditate, this is a waste of time, you don't deserve to make progress. So the smoky mist of doubt and anxiety, a hindrance of doubt and anxiety. So each of us will have our own preferred smoky hindrance and stories, but the process is the same. So how does the Buddha respond? Well, the Buddha responds, he enters into an exchange with the Naga. The Buddha fills the fire chamber with smoke of his own, purifying the fire chamber, clearing the mind. So for me, this would be something like applied thinking. So something along the lines of, well, I know meditation works. I've experienced the benefits. I've changed. I can see that I've changed. I can see that others have changed. So if we unhook ourselves from the prapancha, from the stories going around in our mind, we can clarify our intention, drop back into our experience in the body. And if we can do that, well, then our experience deepens. We can drop below the surface of prapancha, the kind of surface chatter, and we can drop into a deeper layer of ourselves, a deeper layer of energy and emotion, which is underlying and perhaps directing the train of thought, the prapancha. And when we do this, sometimes the whole body might feel charged with energy or emotion. And that's when we feel the real heat of the strong emotion. That's when we experience the flames of the naga. So the next weapon we need when we encounter a naga or a dragon is kshanti, or forbearance. And that's the quality that allows us to sit with an uncomfortable experience, to sit with unpleasant vedana, and not to close down, not to turn away, not to kind of bounce back into our surface chatter, but just to stay with the uncomfortable experience. There are many examples in the Pali Canon of a figure called Mara appearing to the Buddha. And the Buddha never tries to get rid of Mara or to fight him away. The Buddha just simply says, I see you. And Mara is allowed to stay, but he's no longer got any power, no influence over the Buddha. And there's, on the night of the enlightenment of the Buddha just sat there completely equanimous, whilst Mara throwing all kinds of weapons of fury and desire the Buddha's way, and the Buddha just sits there completely unmoved, completely equanimous. And I think that's very striking, actually, the Buddha's just ability just to sit there with whatever is there, whatever arises. So in this same chapter, the same seminar, so the chapter of the snake, Sangharakshita says, wrath, anger, fury may arise in the mind, and this is natural. Sometimes situations do occur, or you have experiences that make you angry, even furious. In a sense, you can't help that. What you can help is that you don't give way to it. You don't let it rage unrestrained. This does not mean pretending you don't feel angry. It's not, as it were, alienating yourself from the feeling of being angry. It's saying to yourself, yes, I'm very angry, rightly or wrongly. This is what I feel. This is what I experience. But it would not be skillful of me to give outward expression to this. So Sangharakshita says we need to experience the emotions that arise. And sometimes we need to be allowed space by others to experience our anger. And he mentions an example of a Victorian thinker called Herbert Spencer, who sometimes would come down for breakfast wearing a woolen suit. And if Herbert Spencer came down for breakfast wearing this particular woolen suit, well, the rest of his family knew not to speak to him. And they knew they needed to give him a wide berth because he was in a bad mood. And Sangharakshita suggests, well, perhaps in our communities or homes, we need the equivalent of Herbert Spencer's woolen suit, so our friends know when to give us some space. And this has been important for me over the past few years. I found myself sometimes experiencing waves of strong anger, often completely unrelated to what's happening around me. But it's as though it's the anger relating to something that happened years ago, which I never really experienced fully at the time. And I've been very grateful to Lucy, my wife Lucy, because she's been very patient with me, and she, you know, sometimes been very great just at allowing me to experience the anger and giving me the space to do that sometimes when I need to. So I can remember one day going for a walk in the Botanical Gardens in Sheffield and saying to Lucy, I'm just really angry, it's got nothing to do with you. But I just, you know, I, in a way, I need to experience it. I can't help but experience it. But it's got nothing to do with you. So the anger, whatever is there, needs to be experienced fully. The flames of the naga are experienced fully by the Buddha. But it's very important to note that the flames are contained within the fire chamber. They don't spill out and harm any of the observers outside. So the emotion is experienced fully and allowed to rise and pass, but it's not acted out. So in meditation, there's no danger of us speaking or acting out of the anger or craving, but it's important we don't get caught up in the stories or prapancha, which will feed the anger and cause future suffering. So we don't replay the situation over and over in our mind. We don't think, yes, but she did this and I'm going to do that. We unhook from all of that surface chatter and the stories, and we just experience the raw emotion or energy, wherever it manifests in the body, So in a way, the body is the vessel. The body is the vessel that allows us to contain and to hold that experience, to hold that emotion and the energy. Now, there's two dangers that I need to be clear about and to point out. So the first one is that this doesn't relate to you if you're already in touch with your anger. If you have no problem at all expressing and experiencing your anger, if you're an angry person already, don't use this as an excuse to say, well, Bodhinaga says it's okay for me to shout at you and be angry. I'm not saying that. That's not what I'm saying. So if you're that kind of person, this doesn't apply to you. And secondly, a second danger is that it is possible to get a bit self-obsessed and precious with our inner experience, with our emotions. We can become, in a way, dominated by whatever is going on for us internally and just lose sight of the people around us and our goal. So that's another, you know, the other extreme, that's another danger we can fall into. So going back to the sutta. So the Buddha has entered the fire chamber and he's countered the smoke of the Naga with smoke of his own. And then the Naga gets furious and produces flames. How does the Buddha respond? What does the Buddha do? Well, the Buddha produces flames of his own without harming the Naga. So in some stories, such as the Christian version of St. George and the dragon is slain, the dragon is killed. But if you slay the dragon, you don't get the treasure. You don't get the real treasure. So what's the treasure? Well, we'll come on to that in a little while. But the Buddha matches the furious flames of the Naga with his own flames. But these aren't the flames of anger and hatred. These are the flames of transformation. These are the flames of metta and compassion. When we push down and repress our emotions, the aversion and the hostility gets mirrored back to us. The more we push down the emotions, the more hostile they appear. And the more furious the dragon becomes. And the sixth verse of the Dhammapada, in the sixth verse the Buddha says, hatreds cannot be conquered by hatred. They can only be conquered by love. This is the eternal law. And there are two anecdotes that help to illustrate this for me. And the first is the story of a horse trainer who was the grandfather of a friend of mine called Padmashalin from Venezuela. So Padmashalin told me his grandfather used to tame wild horses. But he didn't need to use any rope or any force to tame the horses. Well, it was impossible to do it that way. Instead, he would tame them using kindness and love. He learned that if he treated the wild horses with extreme kindness, it was possible to develop a very deep bond of trust with the horses. And they would be loyal without any need for restraint or force. They would sometimes disappear for a day or two, but they'd always come back. So they'd retain the wildness and the freedom, but they'd become loyal to this man. And the second story is a story of my cat, Missy. So Lucy and I rescued two cats from a cat shelter in Broom Hill about 4 years ago. And they were feral wild cats. One of them was very tame, both very frightened, but one quite tame, and one completely wild, called Missy, which we called a Missy. And so if you went in the same room as this cat, she'd run out, either run out of the room or just hide in a corner. And if you went in the same room, if you moved towards her, she'd hiss violently. And Lucy's got scars on her arm from when she tried to take her to the vet one time. So basically this cat was really violent, wild cat. And they told us at the cat shelter that we probably would be never able to stroke Missy. But I had an intuitive sense at the time that what I needed to do was just to sit in the room with Missy and not do anything. Just to sit in the same room and not move towards her, not try and stroke her, but just to sit in the room with her. And I did that for a long time, and after a year of doing that, Missy allowed us to stroke her for the first time. She allowed us to stroke her. And then now she's a completely different cat, and she's completely loyal to me, to the extent that she just follows me around the house. So when I go to sleep, she sleeps on top of my legs at night. If I get up to go to the loo in the night, she follows me to the bathroom. she walks back and jumps on my legs again. But if any other human being enters the house, she'll hide again, or she'll hide under basically under the bed, or she'll run out. So, but she, in a way, just by through not trying to do anything, just by sitting in the same room as a cat, she's been won round. And for me, this is a very good metaphor for my mind, actually, how I experience parts of my mind. There are certain wilder energies that appear destructive and violent. And it could help to relate to those parts of our mind, either as, you know, a wild horse that we can befriend, or a frightened animal which we can reassure and win over. So the Buddha counters the flames of the Naga with his own flames of metta and compassion, and he waits. And he stands his ground. He isn't afraid of the flames of the dragon. He doesn't back down. He stays in the fire chamber as long as it takes to win the respect of the Naga and to get the treasure. So the Buddha stays in the fire chamber all through the night until he emerges, and he emerges with the Naga curled up inside his begging bowl. And he says to Kashyapa, "Here is your Naga, Kashyapa. I have countered his fire with fire." I'll put the Naga down there. Carefully. So, yeah, for me, this is a symbol of the Buddha having the Naga at his command. The Naga is at the service of the Buddha. It's a symbol for having all the energy which used to be tied up in anger, ill will or craving. Having all of that energy behind the spiritual life. Having all of that energy at your fingertips whenever you need it. So in this same seminar, Sangharakshita says, "In a highly developed person, his energy, even in a sense his anger, is not pulled back. The energy is there and is available. It doesn't move until it is given the word. It is completely, as it were, obedient. For us, it's quite difficult to imagine having a very powerful emotion, usually labelled as unskillful, and just having it there. It's available and it isn't actually going out. If we can be in that state, all our energy is there. The potentiality of anger is there, but we don't become angry. Well, then that is very positive. Then we have lots of energy and we're very alive. So when our emotions are flowing and unblocked, and we've turned the volume up on our emotional life, and we're able to contain it, well, then we're able to feel strongly and to care passionately about our values. We want to protect what's important. Nothing will stop us from practicing, from building Sangha. So when our energy is available and is obedient in this way, it becomes harnessed for our spiritual practice. The energy that was initially turned inwards as anger becomes available as a protector of your values, a protector of the Dharma. And one way this has been expressed in my spiritual life is that I've recently noticed I'm becoming more readily able to speak out. If I disagree with something, speak out to protect something that's important to me. So there's been a process that's seen me move from feeling ashamed about my anger, being angry at myself, to allowing the anger to be there. And now my emotions are flowing more easily, and I'm beginning to harness the energy from that, and to care more deeply about the spiritual life, about spiritual values, and to want to protect them. And I've noticed Maitridasa is very good in this area. His emotions are freely flowing. He's not afraid to be emotional. And also he's not afraid to speak out. He'll speak out very calmly but very strongly if he doesn't agree with something. And he seems to have lots of energy available to work in the shop or to work in the Buddhist centre, whatever needs to be done. So if we can harness our energies and our emotions, and we're not afraid to be emotional, well, then all that energy becomes available. So, as well as being harnessed in this way as a volitional and protective force, there's another part of the process, which I haven't got too much time to go into today, but that's the process of refining our energies, refining our emotions and energies. Through ethical practice and metta-bhavana practice, we're creating positive channels for our emotions to flow down, skillful channels that our emotions can flow down. And when we unearth and unblock these energies and emotions, they can start to flow down these new channels. So initially, these Naga energies might appear as coarse, wild energies. But we can express these energies through physical activity or exercise or something creative, such as music, art or poetry. And we can learn to speak the language of our depths, particularly looking out for things like any vivid dreams we might have. And gradually, we can begin to refine our energies through creative activity, the arts and spiritual friendship. So if you're interested in that process, I recommend that you read a book called The Religion of Art by Sangharakshita. He talks about this process a lot in there. Also, there's a paper called Reimagining the Buddha, where it's talked about as well. So if we can sit with the Naga, then our our deeper energies become available to protect what's highest. In a similar way to like the Naga king, Mucchalinda, who protects the Buddha after his awakening, who circles around the Buddha. So our inner world becomes richer and more refined, but we still haven't got to the treasure. What is the treasure? What's the treasure that we get from the Naga or the dragon? Well, the Nagas and dragons are protectors of wisdom or insight. So that's a big goal on the way to awakening to enlightenment. So this is a very rough depiction of the wheel and the spiral. We've got the wheel of samsara, where we go round and round in our ruts, in our reactive habits. But then when we start to practice spiritually, we start to act in the gap, where we've seen where we can go up and up the spiral path, which eventually leads to insight and to awakening. And in each stage of the spiral path, well, each new stage comes out of the fullness of the stage before. And the stage before insight is samadhi. So samadhi is often translated as concentration. I don't quite like that translation of samadhi, because I think it can be misleading. I think it can lead to the spiritual bypassing that I spoke about earlier, where a meditator might forcibly concentrate the mind thinking that it's going to lead to insight or to wisdom. But if they're forcing a very narrow part of themselves into concentration, they're bypassing lots of their energies, leaving them behind. That doesn't lead to wisdom. So in the Three Jewels, a book called The Three Jewels, Sangharaksha is talking about the stages of the spiral path. And he translates samadhi as something like psychic wholeness, which I prefer, a psychic wholeness which leads to insight. And he says, the concentrated mind sees things as they are, but if the samadhi is not true samadhi, but a mere forcible fixation of attention, disrupting one part of the psyche from the rest, there will arise from it nothing but delusions. The perfect samadhi which leads to insight involves not the forcible fixation of the mind on an object, and not merely the exercise of understanding and will, but the transformation and integration of the total psyche in all its sublimest heights and most abysmal depths. So if you integrate and harness your energies, and if you cultivate positive emotion, well, what follows is spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. So the stage of spiritual death is a stage that's often correlated with insight. That's the stage of the arising of insight or wisdom. So if we fully go through the process of integration and positive emotion, if we gather all of the different parts of ourselves together and cultivate a more and more positive energy, well, then we can. That's what leads to insight arising. In last week's talk, Maitridasa spoke about the Lord of the Rings, and he spoke about the Balrog in Lord of the Rings, which comes in deep in the minds of Moria. Now, fans of the Lord of the Rings, I'm a fan of the Lord of the Rings, and fans of Lord of the Rings will know what happens next. And what happens next is that Gandalf the Grey, in order for the Fellowship to survive and escape, Gandalf the Grey has to die. He uses all of his energies to contain the Balrog, and in doing that, he dies as Gandalf the Grey, only to be reborn later in the story as a new figure called Gandalf the White, who is a kind of mysterious, almost transcendental figure who appears later on in the story. So the treasure that we get from a dragon or a naga is spiritual death or insight. So the dragon doesn't get killed, you do. Or rather, what dies is your limiting ideas and views about yourself and the world. You see through this limited, fixed sense of yourself, and the treasure of insight and all the riches of the spiritual life are available to you. And this is apparent elsewhere in the Buddhist tradition as well. So we've got the example I talked about earlier of the Naga king, Mucchalinda, who protects the Buddha after his awakening. And after this episode, the Buddha utters a verse of inspiration, exclaiming that of all the blissful experiences on the path, the ultimate bliss is spiritual death and rebirth, or subduing of the conceit of I, it's translated as. So the treasure, or the ultimate bliss, is seen through the fixed and limiting views of yourself. And there's another figure on the refuge tree called Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna was a very important Indian teacher from the 2nd century. And Nagarjuna is credited with the perfection of wisdom teachings, which include the Heart Sutra. And these form the basis of the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism, which we'll come across later in the year, I imagine. So I'm sure you've all come across the Heart Sutra in pujas. And the perfection of wisdom sutras, they're very mysterious, and they're based upon the experience of shunyata, or a mysterious void it's sometimes called. And these sutras, they're concerned with the removal of any way we might try to fix and limit reality or ourselves. They're aimed at baffling the rider of the rational mind, so that he stops arguing with the horse or the depths. And interestingly, Nagarjuna is depicted as having serpents growing out of his head, which is very interesting. And Nagarjuna is said to have discovered this insight or wisdom of the Heart Sutra and the perfection of wisdom. When he was given it, he was given this treasure of these texts by a Naga princess, after the Nagas have been protecting this insight, this wisdom in the depths of the ocean. So there's a well-established link between Nagas and insight into the way things are. Even the Buddha and his awakened disciples, they're sometimes referred to in the Pali Canon as Nagas. The Buddha is sometimes referred to as a Naga. And there's a great verse from a text in the Pali Canon called the Udana. And it's one of the earliest texts that we know of. And the Buddha says, "Just as the great ocean holds many precious jewels, so too this Dhamma holds many treasures, such treasures as the four Satipatthanas and the Noble Eightfold Path. Just as the great ocean is the abode of whales, sea serpents, demons and monsters whose lengths are hundreds of leagues, so too this Dhamma is the abode of great beings, such beings as the stream entrant and the awakened ones." So now you know what to do if you meet a dragon or a Naga in your meditation. If you want to harness the energies of the Nagas and win the great treasure of insight and wisdom, well, don't run away. Don't run away from the dragon. But instead use the weapons of mindfulness, kshanti, and above all, treat your Naga with kindness and respect, because you never know, it might be the Buddha.